Welcome to The Mildly Interesting with Oliver Wilson, the official bedtime podcast of former insomniacs. Tomorrow is Thursday, December 2nd, National Fritters Day. Fritters are popular all over the world, though they're not called fritters everywhere you go. In Asia, several varieties, including the Burmese Acho, which is popularly made with a rich gourd filling, are typically served with tea or for breakfast. Tempura is also considered a fritter, with one of the most popular being pisang goreng, a banana-based fritter. In Indonesia, the perfect accompaniment to fritter is bird's eye chili. You may have your favorite fritter, but have you ever wondered about its history? Well, I have. And I think you might just find it mildly interesting. Subscribe to The Mildly Interesting on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are available. We'll be right back. A fritter is a portion of meat, seafood, fruit, vegetables, or other ingredients which have been battered or breaded, or just a portion of dough without further ingredients, that is deep-fried. Fritters are prepared in both sweet and savory varieties. The 1854 edition of an American Dictionary of the English Language by Noah Webster defines fritter as a transitive verb meaning to cut meat into small pieces to be fried. Another definition from 1861 is a pancake conte. Chopped fruit, poultry, fish, also a small piece of meat fried. West African countries have many variations similar to fritters. The most common process includes blending peeled black-eyed peas with peppers and spices to leave a thick texture. A Yoruba version, akara, is a popular street snack and side dish in Nigerian culture. Pumpkin fritters, served with cinnamon sugar at any time of day, are famous in South Africa. Fritters are trendy roadside snacks all over South Asia and are commonly referred to as pakora, pokoda, or bhaji, bhajia, in local parlance. The onion bhaji also enjoys high popularity abroad and at home. In India, a pakora is a fritter of assorted vegetables and spices. In the South Indian state of Kerala, banana fritters are extremely popular. Paeji is a Bengali dish of fritters with onions. In Brunei, fritters are known as kukur, and they are eaten as snacks. Kukur is also part of local street food, and is usually sold in street market-style food booths, locally known as jirai. They are usually made with fillings commonly made with banana, shrimp, yam, sweet potatoes, and vegetables, usually sliced cabbages or carrots. Some local fruits, when they are in season, are also made into kukur, most commonly durian, breadfruit, shukan, tibidak, Articarpus integer, and terap, Articarpus odoratissimus. In Indonesia, fritters come under gorengan, Indonesian, fritters, from goreng to fry, and many varieties are sold on traveling carts or by street vendors throughout Indonesia. Various kinds of ingredients are battered and deep-fried, such as bananas, pisang goreng, tempe mendon, tahu goreng, fried tofu, ongkom, sweet potato, cassava chunk, cassava topai, sereng, tapioca fritters, bakewan, flour with chopped vegetables, tahu icy, filled tofu, and breadfruit. These are often eaten accompanied by fresh bird's eye chili. The variety known as bakewan commonly contains flour with chopped vegetables such as carrot and cabbage, whereas the fried patties called perkedel typically consist of mashed potatoes or ground corn, perkedel jagung or bakewan jagung. In Malaysia, it is typical for a fritter called kukur, such as yam, sweet potato, and banana, to be fried by the roadside in a large wok and sold as snacks. In Burmese cuisine, fritters are called acho, Burmese, while assorted fritters are called acho son, Burmese. The most popular acho is the gourd fritter. Diced onions, chickpea, potatoes, various leafy vegetables, brown bean paste, Burmese tofu, chayote, banana, and crackling are other popular fritter ingredients. Black beans are made with curry leaves to make baeguor, small fritters similar to falafel. Unlike pisang goreng, Burmese banana fritters are made only with overripe bananas added, with no sugar or honey. The savory fritters are eaten mainly at breakfast, or as a snack at tea. Gourd, chickpea, and onion fritters are cut into small parts and eaten with mohinga, Myanmar's national dish. These fritters are also eaten with cowheen born rice and Burmese green sauce, called chin so ka or a chin ye. Depending on the fritter hawker, the sauce is made from chili sauce diluted with vinegar, water, cilantro, finely diced tomatoes, garlic, and onions. In the Philippines, egg fritters are called toknaneng, quail, or kwek kwek, duck, and squid fritters are called calamares. These, along with shrimp fritters called okoy and banana fritters called mawa, are also sold in traveling carts or streetside vendors. Throughout China, fritters are sold on roadsides. They may contain pork but are commonly vegetarian. In Japanese cuisine, tempura is vegetable or seafood dipped and fried in a light crispy batter and served as a common accompaniment to meals. In Korean cuisine, deep fries are known as twijim. Twijim is often battered and breaded, but there are varieties without breading and breading and batter. Popular twijim dishes include dak twijim, fried chicken, gimmari twijim, fried seaweed roll, gogama twijim, fried sweet potato, gul twijim, fried oyster, ojingyo twijim, fried squid, and sew twijim, fried shrimp. Traditional vegetarian deep fries associated with Korean temple cuisine include twigak and bugak. Twigak is made from vegetables such as dasima, kelp, and bamboo shoot, without breading or batter. Bugak is made from vegetables such as dasima, perilla leaves, and chili peppers, coated with glutinous rice paste and dried thoroughly. The Iranian variety is called kuku, which comes in different versions like the ones with potatoes or the ones with herbs. This type of fritter resembles a crustless quiche. Whitebait fritters are famous in New Zealand. In British fish and chip shops, the fish and chips can be accompanied by fritters, which means a food item, such as a slice of potato, a pineapple ring, an apple ring or chunks, or mushy peas fried in batter. Hence, potato fritter, pineapple fritter, apple fritter, pea fritter, etc. Fritters are also sometimes made with meat at home and at school, especially spam and corned beef. A fritter roll or roll and fritter is a potato fritter inside a bread roll, served with salt and vinegar. In the United States, fritters are a primary ingredient mixed with an egg and milk batter and either pan-fried or deep-fried, wheat flour, cornmeal, or a mix of the two may be used to bind the batter. Corn fritters are often made with whole canned corn and are generally deep-fried. Apple fritters are well known, although the contemporary American apple fritter is unlike the British one. Older versions of the apple fritter in the United States were prepared in the style of British ones by slicing apples, dipping them in batter, and frying them. A Canadian apple fritter is a yeast-leavened deep-fried pastry. Dough that was left to rise is then rolled with apple filling and cinnamon. It is then broken up into pieces and reformed into a single unit mass. From there, it is cut into portions, left to rise, or fried immediately. It is topped or dipped in glaze icing and served hot or cold. It was invented by Tim Hortons in 1964 as an original pastry product. When we return, Noah Webster Jr. Noah Webster Jr., October 16, 1758, May 28, 1843, was an American lexicographer, textbook pioneer, English language spelling reformer, political writer, editor, and author. He has been called the father of American scholarship and education. His blue-backed speller books taught five generations of American children how to spell and read. Webster's name has become synonymous with dictionary in the United States, especially the modern Merriam-Webster Dictionary, first published in 1828, as an American dictionary of the English language. Born in West Hartford, Connecticut, Webster graduated from Yale College in 1778. After studying law under Oliver Ellsworth and others, he passed the bar examination but could not find work as a lawyer. He found some financial success by opening a private school and writing a series of educational books, including The Blue-Backed Speller. A strong supporter of the American Revolution and the ratification of the United States Constitution, Webster later criticized American society for needing an intellectual foundation. He believed that American nationalism was superior to Europe because American values were superior. In 1793, Alexander Hamilton recruited Webster to move to New York City and become an editor for a Federalist Party newspaper. He became a prolific author, publishing newspaper articles, political essays, and textbooks. He returned to Connecticut in 1798, and served in the Connecticut House of Representatives. Webster founded the Connecticut Society for the Abolition of Slavery in 1791, but later became somewhat disillusioned with the abolitionist movement. In 1806, Webster published his first dictionary, a compendious dictionary of the English language. He started working on an expanded and comprehensive dictionary the following year, finally publishing it in 1828. He was very influential in popularizing sure spellings in the United States. He was also influential in establishing the Copyright Act of 1831, the first major statutory revision of U.S. copyright law. While working on the second volume of his dictionary, Webster died in 1843, and the rights to the dictionary were acquired by George and Charles Merriam. Webster was born in the Western Division of Hartford, which became West Hartford, Connecticut, to an established family. His birthplace is the Noah Webster House, which highlights Webster's life, and is the headquarters of the West Hartford Historical Society. His father, Noah Webster Sr., 1722-1813, was a descendant of Connecticut Governor John Webster. His mother, Mercy Steele Webster, 1727-1794, was a descendant of Governor William Bradford of Plymouth Colony. His father was primarily a farmer, though he was also a deacon of the local Congregational Church, captain of the town's militia, and a founder of a local book society, a precursor to the public library. After American independence, he has appointed a justice of the peace. Webster's father never attended college, but he was intellectually curious and prized in education. Webster's mother spent long hours teaching her children spelling, mathematics, and music. At age 6, Webster began attending a dilapidated one-room primary school built by West Hartford's Ecclesiastical Society. Years later, he described the teachers as the dregs of humanity and complained that the instruction was mainly religious. Webster's experiences there motivated him to improve the educational experience of future generations. At age 14, his church pastor began tutoring him in Latin and Greek to prepare him for entering Yale College. Webster enrolled at Yale just before his 16th birthday, studying during his senior year with Ezra Stiles, Yale's president. His 4 years at Yale overlapped the American Revolutionary War and, because of food shortages and the possibility of the British invasion, many of his classes had to be held in other towns. Webster served in the Connecticut Militia. His father had mortgaged the farm to send Webster to Yale, but he was now on his own and had nothing more to do with his family. Webster lacked career plans after graduating from Yale in 1779, later writing that a liberal arts education disqualifies a man for business. He taught school briefly in Glastonbury, but the working conditions were harsh and the pay low. He quit studying law. While studying law under future U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth, Webster also taught full-time in Hartford, which was grueling and ultimately impossible to continue. He quit his legal studies for a year and lapsed into a depression. He then found another practicing attorney to tutor him, completed his studies, and passed the bar examination in 1781. As the Revolutionary War was still going on, he could not find work as a lawyer. He received a master's degree from Yale by giving an oral dissertation to the Yale graduating class. Later that year, he opened a small private school in Western Connecticut that was a success. Nevertheless, he soon closed it and left town, probably because of a failed romance. Turning to literary work as a way to overcome his losses and channel his ambitions, he began writing a series of well-received articles for a prominent New England newspaper justifying and praising the American Revolution and arguing that the separation from Britain would be a permanent state of affairs. He then founded a private school catering to wealthy parents in Goshen, New York, and, by 1785, he had written his speller, a grammar book, and a reader for elementary schools. Proceeds from continuing sales of the popular blue-backed speller enabled Webster to spend many years working on his famous dictionary. Webster was by nature a revolutionary seeking American independence from the cultural thraldom to Europe. To replace it, he sought to create a utopian America, cleansed of luxury and ostentation, and the champion of freedom. By 1781, Webster had an expansive view of the new nation. American nationalism was superior to Europe because American values were superior, he claimed. America sees the absurdities, she sees the kingdoms of Europe, disturbed by wrangling sectaries or their commerce, population, and improvements of every kind cramped and retarded, because the human mind like the body is fettered and bound fast by the cords of policy and superstition, she laughs at their folly and shuns their errors, she founds her empire upon the idea of universal toleration, she admits all religions into her bosom, she secures the sacred rights of every individual, and, astonishing absurdity to Europeans, she sees a thousand discordant opinions live in the strictest harmony, it will finally raise her to a pitch of greatness and luster before which the glory of ancient Greece and Rome shall dwindle to a point. The splendor of modern empires fades into obscurity. Webster dedicated his speller and dictionary to providing an intellectual foundation for American nationalism. From 1787 to 1789, Webster was an outspoken supporter of the new Constitution. In October 1787, he wrote a pamphlet entitled An Examination into the Leading Principles of the Federal Constitution proposed by the late convention held at Philadelphia, published under the pen name A Citizen of America. The pamphlet was influential, particularly outside New York State. In terms of political theory, he de-emphasized virtue, a core value of republicanism, and emphasized widespread property ownership, an essential element of federalism. He was one of the few Americans who paid much attention to French theorist Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It was not Rousseau's politics but his ideas on pedagogy in Emile, 1762, that influenced Webster in adjusting his speller to the stages of a child's development. Noah Webster married Rebecca Greenleaf, 1766 to 1847, on October 26, 1789, in Connecticut. They had 8 children. Webster married well and had joined the elite in Hartford but did not have much money. In 1793, Alexander Hamilton lent him $1,500 to move to New York City to edit the leading Federalist Party newspaper. In December, he founded New York's first daily newspaper, American Minerva, later known as the Commercial Advertiser, which he edited for 4 years, writing the equivalent of 20 volumes of articles and editorials. He also published the semi-weekly publication The Herald, a gazette for the country, later known as the New York Spectator. As a Federalist spokesman, he defended the administrations of George Washington and John Adams, especially their policy of neutrality between Britain and France, and he especially criticized the excesses of the French Revolution and its reign of terror. When French ambassador Citizen Genet set up a network of pro-Jacobin democratic republican societies that entered American politics and attacked President Washington, he condemned them. He later defended Jay's treaty between the United States and Britain. As a result, he was repeatedly denounced by the Jeffersonian Republicans as a pusillanimous, half-begotten, self-dubbed patriot, an incurable lunatic, and a deceitful newsmonger, pedagogue, and quack. For decades, he was one of the most prolific authors in the New Nation, publishing textbooks, political essays, a report on infectious diseases, and newspaper articles for his Federalist Party. He wrote so much that a modern bibliography of his published works required 655 pages. He moved back to New Haven in 1798, he was elected as a Federalist to the Connecticut House of Representatives in 1800 and 1802 to 1807. Webster was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1799. He moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, in 1812, where he helped to found Amherst College. In 1822, the family moved back to New Haven, where Webster was awarded an honorary degree from Yale the following year. In 1827, Webster was elected to the American Philosophical Society. As a teacher, he had come to dislike American elementary schools. They could be overcrowded, with up to 70 children of all ages crammed into one-room schoolhouses. They had poor, underpaid staff, no desks, and unsatisfactory textbooks that came from England. Webster thought Americans should learn from American books, so he began writing the 3-volume compendium A Grammatical Institute of the English Language. The work consisted of a speller, published in 1783, a grammar, published in 1784, and a reader, published in 1785. His goal was to provide a uniquely American approach to training children. His most significant improvement, he claimed, was to rescue our native tongue from the clamor of pedantry that surrounded English grammar and pronunciation. He complained that the British aristocracy corrupted the English language, which set its own standard for proper spelling and pronunciation. Webster rejected the notion that the study of Greek and Latin must precede the study of English grammar. According to Webster, the appropriate standard for the American language was the same Republican principles as American civil and ecclesiastical constitutions. This meant that the people at large must control the language, popular sovereignty in government must be accompanied by widespread usage in language. The speller was arranged to be easily taught to students, and it progressed by age. From his own experiences as a teacher, Webster thought that the speller should be simple and give an orderly presentation of words and the rules of spelling and pronunciation. He believed that students learned most readily when he broke a complex problem into its component parts and had each pupil master one part before moving to the next. Ellis argues that Webster anticipated some of the insights currently associated with Jean Piaget's theory of cognitive development. Webster said that children pass through distinctive learning phases in which they master increasingly complex or abstract tasks. Therefore, teachers must not teach a three-year-old how to read, they could not do it until age five. He organized his speller accordingly, beginning with the alphabet and moving systematically through the different sounds of vowels and consonants, then syllables, then simple words, more complex words, then sentences. The speller was initially titled the first part of the Grammatical Institute of the English Language. Throughout 385 editions in his lifetime, the title was changed in 1786 to the American Spelling Book and again in 1829 to the Elementary Spelling Book. Most people called it the blue-backed speller because of its blue cover, and, for the next 100 years, Webster's book taught children how to read, spell, and pronounce words. It was the most famous American book of its time. By 1837, it had sold 15 million copies and some 60 million by 1890, reaching most young students in the first century. Its royalty of a half cent per copy was enough to sustain Webster in his other endeavors. It also helped create the popular contests known as spelling bees. As time went on, Webster changed the spellings in the book to more phonetic ones. Most of them already existed as alternative spellings. He chose spellings such as defense, color, and traveler and changed the re to er in words such as center. He also changed his tongue to the older spelling tongue, but this did not catch on. Part 3 of his Grammatical Institute, 1785, was a reader designed to uplift the mind and diffuse the principles of virtue and patriotism. In the choice of pieces, he explained, "I have not been inattentive to the political interests of America." Several of those masterly addresses of Congress, written at the commencement of the late Revolution, contain such noble, just, and independent sentiments of liberty and patriotism, that I cannot help wishing to transfuse them into the breasts of the rising generation. Students received the usual quota of Plutarch, Shakespeare, Swift, and Addison and such Americans as Joel Barlow's Vision of Columbus, Timothy Dwight's Conquest of Canaan, and John Trumbull's poem Fingal. He included excerpts from Tom Paine's The Crisis and an essay by Thomas Day calling for the abolition of slavery according to the Declaration of Independence. Webster's speller was entirely secular by design. It ended with two pages of important dates in American history, beginning with Columbus's discovery of America in 1492 and ending with the Battle of Yorktown in 1781. there was no mention of God, the Bible, or sacred events. Let sacred things be appropriated for sacred purposes, Webster wrote. As Ellis explains, Webster began to construct a secular catechism to the nation-state. Here was the first appearance of civics in American school books. In this sense, Webster's speller becoming what was to be the secular successor to the New England primer with its explicitly biblical injunctions. Later in life, Webster became intensely religious and added religious themes. However, after 1840, Webster's books lost market share to the McGuffey eclectic readers of William Holmes McGuffey, which sold over 120 million copies. Vincent P. Beinock, 1984, examines Webster about his commitment to the idea of a unified American national culture that would stave off the decline of Republican virtues and solidarity. Webster acquired his perspective on language from such theorists as Maupertuis, Michaelis, and Herder. He found the belief that a nation's linguistic forms and the thoughts correlated with them shaped individuals' behavior. Thus, the etymological clarification and reform of American English promised to improve citizens' manners and preserve republican purity and social stability. This presupposition animated Webster's speller and grammar. In 1806, Webster published his first dictionary, a compendious dictionary of the English language. In 1807, Webster began compiling an expanded and fully comprehensive dictionary, an American Dictionary of the English Language. It took 26 years to complete. To evaluate the etymology of words, Webster learned 28 languages, including Old English, Gothic, German, Greek, Latin, Italian, Spanish, French, Dutch, Welsh, Russian, Hebrew, Aramaic, Persian, Arabic, and Sanskrit. Webster hoped to standardize American speech since Americans in different parts of the country used different languages. They also spelled, pronounced, and used English words differently. Webster completed his dictionary during his year abroad in January 1825 in a boarding house in Cambridge, England. His book contained 70,000 words, of which 12,000 had never appeared in a published dictionary before. As a spelling reformer, Webster preferred spellings that matched pronunciation better. In a companion to the American Revolution, 2008, John Algio notes, "It is often assumed that characteristically American spellings were invented by Noah Webster. He was very influential in popularizing certain spellings in America, but he did not originate them. Rather, he chose already existing options such as center, color, and check on such grounds as simplicity, analogy, or etymology. He also added American words, like skunk, that did not appear in British dictionaries." At the age of 70, Webster published his dictionary in 1828, registering the copyright on April 14. Though it now has an honored place in the history of American English, Webster's first dictionary only sold 2,500 copies. He was forced to mortgage his home to develop a second edition, and for the rest of his life, he had debt problems. In 1840, the second edition was published in two volumes. On May 28, 1843, a few days after making more specific definitions to the second edition, Noah Webster died with much of his efforts with the dictionary still unrecognized. His last words were, "I am entirely submissive to the will of God." He died later that evening. The rights to his dictionary were acquired by George and Charles Merriam in 1843 from Webster's estate, and all contemporary Merriam-Webster dictionaries trace their lineage to that of Webster, although many others have adopted his name, attempting to share in the popularity. He is buried in New Haven's Grove Street Cemetery. Lepore, 2008, demonstrates Webster's paradoxical ideas about language and politics and shows why Webster's endeavors were at first so poorly received. Culturally conservative Federalists denounced the work as radical, too inclusive in its lexicon and even vulgar. Meanwhile, Webster's old foes, the Republicans, attacked the man, labeling him mad for such an undertaking. Scholars have long seen Webster's 1844 dictionary as an essential resource for reading poet Emily Dickinson's life and work. She once commented that the lexicon was her only companion for years. One biographer said, "The dictionary was no mere reference book to her. She read it as a priest his breviary, over and over, page by page, with utter absorption." Nathan Austin has explored the intersection of lexicographical and poetic practices in American literature and attempts to map out lexical poetics using Webster's definitions as his base. Poet's mind, his dictionaries, often drawing upon the lexicography to express wordplay. Austin explicates key definitions from both the Compendious, 1806, and American, 1828, dictionaries and finds a range of themes such as the politics of American versus British English, and issues of national identity and independent culture. Austin argues that Webster's dictionaries helped redefine Americanism in an era of highly flexible cultural identity. Webster himself saw the dictionaries as a nationalizing device to separate America from Britain, calling his project a federal language, with competing forces towards regularity on the one hand and innovation on the other. Austin suggests that the contradictions of Webster's lexicography were part of a more extensive play between liberty and order within American intellectual discourse, with some pulled toward Europe and the past and others pulled toward America and the new future. In 1850, Blackie and Son in Glasgow published the first general dictionary of English that relied heavily upon pictorial illustrations integrated with the text. The Imperial Dictionary, English, Technological, and Scientific, adapted to the present state of literature, science, and art, based on Webster's English Dictionary, used Webster's for most of their text, adding some additional technical words that went with illustrations of machinery. Webster, in early life, was something of a freethinker, but in 1808 he became a convert to Calvinistic orthodoxy, and after that, became a devout Congregationalist who preached the need to Christianize the nation. Webster grew increasingly authoritarian and elitist, fighting against the prevailing grain of Jacksonian democracy. Webster viewed language as a tool to control unruly thoughts. His American Dictionary emphasized the virtues of social control over human passions and individualism, submission to authority, and fear of God. They were necessary to maintain the American social order. As he grew older, Webster's attitudes changed from an optimistic revolutionary in the 1780s to those of a pessimistic critic of man and society by the 1820s. His 1828 American Dictionary contained the most significant number of biblical definitions given in any reference volume. Webster said of education, "Education is useless without the Bible." The Bible was America's essential textbook in all fields. God's Word, contained in the Bible, has furnished all necessary rules to direct our conduct. Webster released his own edition of the Bible in 1833, called the Common Version. He used the King James Version, KJV, as a base and consulted the Hebrew and Greek in various other versions and commentaries. Webster molded the KJV to correct grammar, replaced words that were no longer used, and removed words and phrases that could be seen as offensive. In 1834, he published Value of the Bible and Excellence of the Christian Religion, an apologetic book defending the Bible and Christianity itself. Webster helped found the Connecticut Society for the Abolition of Slavery in 1791, but by the 1830s, rejected the new tone among abolitionists that emphasized that Americans who tolerated slavery were sinners. In 1837, Webster warned his daughter Eliza about her fervent support of the abolitionist cause. Webster wrote, "Slavery is a great sin, and a general calamity, but it is not our sin, though it may prove to be a terrible calamity to us in the North. But we cannot legally interfere with the South on this subject." He added, "To come North to preach and thus disturb our peace, when we can legally do nothing to effect this object, is, in my view, highly criminal, and the preachers of abolitionism deserve the penitentiary." The Copyright Act of 1831 was the first major statutory revision of U.S. copyright law due to intensive lobbying by Noah Webster and his agents in Congress. Webster also played a critical role lobbying individual states throughout the country during the 1780s to pass the first American copyright laws, which were expected to have distinct nationalistic implications for the young nation.